This is the Gear Patrol podcast for Friday, October 22nd, 2021. There's a lot of T's in there. I'm Nick Caruso, and I'm glad you're here because first we're going to go over the big announcements from this week's Apple Unleashed event, which include everything from new HomePod mini colors to next-gen AirPods to ports on new MacBook Pros. It's kind of like a what's old is new again kind of thing. And then we're going to discuss the just revealed and supremely quick, but still kind of mysterious Porsche 718 Cayman GT4 RS, which is the last internal combustion variant of the Cayman ever before the lineup goes all electric. And then lastly, watchmaker Bremont has revealed its first in-house movement, the ENG 300. But is it actually an original in-house movement? Some say it ain't. We're going to suss it out. But you're going to have to wait for that special little discussion because we're going to do it last. But I want to introduce who is with me today. You're very familiar with them by now. I'm joined by Associate Director of Production Design, Henry Phillips. Hi, Henry.
Hello. Hello, hello.
And also with us, Platforms Editor JD DiGiovanni. Here as well. Hello.
We're bringing the energy today. We're coming in hot. We're talking about ports. We're talking about cars. We're talking about watches. Let's go.
That's right. I know JD has been literally mainlining coffee for the last 10 hours. Mm-hmm. I've got a leaf blower back here. We've got all sorts of stuff going on and just adds to the fun. So we've got a lot to discuss, a lot of details. I said this right before we started. It's like there's a lot of like technical stuff and a lot of little intricate details to all these stories. And interesting that we try to kind of talk about some conceptual stuff on here, but we're talking about like straightforward products for the entire episode this time, which is kind of cool and for many reasons. So let's get right into it. Apple, we've been talking a lot about Apple lately because they have been making a lot of news. And everything from Apple's event this week called Apple Unleashed is pretty exciting. It was the second of the brand's sort of product release events in just a handful of weeks. And a whole slate of stuff was, displayed in their beautiful marketing videos and presentations. I'm going to list all of them right now, but be very light on the details, be very brief, but still hold tight and we'll chat about highlights when I'm done in an hour or so. Here we go. So first, we have new 14 and 16 inch MacBook Pros with all sorts of new features or old features, depending how you look at it. We have AirPods. The regular version of Apple's Buds haven't been updated in a while. This generation, third generation, sees shorter stalks, like the little earpiece parts, and better touch controls, plus spatial audio, Apple's spatial audio tech, longer battery life, and sweat and water resistance. There are a couple new chips for their hardware, the M1 Pro and M1 Max. Suffice it to say, the Pro is very fast and the Max is much faster. And then we'll talk about some of those specs in a second. There are also new colors for the HomePod Mini, which is the little sort of smart speaker, little globe sort of thing. Yellow, orange, and blue colors are now available. And there's a new Apple Music voice plan that gives people access to Apple Music via Siri and voice commands for $4.99 a month. And lastly, Mac OS Monterey, the operating system for your computer, launches next week. Okay, I believe that's it.
Very impressive.
Thank you. I did that in one breath. I don't know if anybody was listening.
I'm the Corona podcasting over here.
Yeah, right. I can't taste anything, but I want to go with JD. I want to go to you first. From your point of view, there's a lot of stuff. What's the biggest story here? Like, what are you most drawn to?
Ports are back, baby. Let's go. I'm just back. I think for me, it's just like, I don't know. I wrote a couple things down, like AirPods seem cool. Okay. Like, Apple Music voice seems like it's going to be great for lobbies. HomePod looks cool. if I lived in a space that was larger than a room, I might think about buying one. But the main thing is just the laptops. I mean, they look so much, I don't know. I mean, the most tangible thing I can say would improve my life is having more ports. I have a couple Thunderbolt ports and a dongle with one USB. And so it makes juggling some things sometimes at work like actually a bit of a pain. And then all the stuff about the chip seems fascinating, but I'm maybe not smart enough to know about like what exactly that means. I have more I want to ask about the chip later, but I think that's my kind of first take there. I'm excited about the ports.
Yeah. There are, as everyone is likely aware, recent iterations of MacBook Pros have done away with most ports. Got a lot of USB-C stuff on there, but like not much else. And that's been sort of controversial for a lot of reasons, namely, you know, when you want to use stuff with your computer and it, you got to dongle it up. Also, it should be noted on these, the touch bar, the little like digital button display bar thing at the top of the old keyboard has been replaced with real keys again. There are thinner bezels. There are nice new displays and more speakers in these things. And there's a notch at the top around the fancy newish camera up there too, the front facing camera, kind of like an iPhone. So a lot of newness, a lot of oldness, and MagSafe is on the charger. Henry, what do you think? What's the big stuff here?
Yeah, MagSafe is great. I am so happy that that's back. But you know, I can't actually recall when the kind of two or four port MacBooks were introduced. But I don't know what the kind of statute of limitations is for getting used to a like kind of radical change on a piece of tech, but I feel like I'm there. The ports are cool. I'm excited for the ports, I think, but I've learned to live without the ports.
So you're saying you have adjusted to the lack of ports.
I like, you know, living in zero G or something. I have the dongles. All my things are USB-C now. I suppose it doesn't matter, but
yeah, I did appreciate the joking that was going on at Apple's expense about how this company's removed a bunch of stuff and then years later put it back. And it's just like, look at how innovative we are. And it is kind of funny to think that like, oh, cool. Like all the things people have been complaining about that seemed like pretty obvious fixes are now like fixed. Casey Johnson, who was on like a few episodes back, she'd written a lot about the Apple keyboard and how bad it was. And like was one of the first people to call it out. That was years ago. And they're finally getting around to it. But I feel like the spiciest take that's come out of any of this stuff was Alex Webb's piece in Bloomberg, where he essentially is making the argument that like maybe Apple's better without Johnny Ive. His impulse to make everything so minimal and so pared down and like beautiful at the expense of actually, I don't know, like, you know, use. Like when I have to charge my Apple mouse, I have to flip it upside down like it's a, I don't know, like a
I'll never dog. Forgive him for that.
Yeah. And then removing all the ports off of your Mac and like making these very slim keyboards and all this other stuff. It's like now that he's gone, they can just get back to focusing on making products that are also very useful, which is quite a take.
I like that. I mean, I think it's weird and I'm conflicted, I think, but the idea that a pro laptop wouldn't have, you know, various features that are widely HDMI. Requested by pros is wild to me. And yeah, I mean, I think I haven't seen anybody, a single person say that they're upset that it's heavier or thicker.
Right. So. I mean, thicker computer than what is currently on offer is really not that big of a deal. I think we just recently talked about this on an episode. It came up I know I was just talking to my 15-year-old nephew about what I used when I was in college, like a, you know, a Dell laptop that was literally 2 inches thick and like could barely, I could barely run like GTA, whatever, Miami, whatever, what doesn't matter. But like everything's thin. It doesn't, you know, a little extra bulk isn't going to make or break anything at this point. These things are so capable and so loaded down. Speaking of loaded down, Henry, you did the exercise of maxing out these things in terms of price. Can you talk about that little?
Yeah, they get really expensive. You know, the kind of adage about Apple products being incredibly expensive for what they are. You know, this is hugely impressive performance wise, but also, you know, you could top it out north of $6,000. Which is wild for a modern laptop, wild for most things, but you know, that's got quite a few weird specs on it. My kind of rough guess was that a well-specced one for someone who can't bear the idea of not having the M1 Max, like myself, for no good reason at all, would cost, you know, $3,200 or so, which is still about, you know,
a boatload of money
more than you need.
Yeah,
it's a ton. It's a ton. But for what it's, you know, for all of the kind of physical changes and ports and kind of concessions to people who have raised very legitimate issues with Apple stuff before, the processors and the systems on a chip are really impressive.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as JD. I don't really, I'm not super adept at understanding chips. Are you able to give us that? Can you school us a little bit?
Absolutely not. But,
you can, Henry.
Well, the idea, like, you know, we've seen this with the M1, when it kind of came out a couple years ago. But it's a really amazing kind of efficient design, that's pretty much perfectly suited for laptops. It draws a comparatively tiny amount of power and produces a ton of processing power. And so you end up with, on the lower end ones, on the Air and the 13-inch Pro, it meant that you could have great battery life and not use fans. Like the right. MacBook Air doesn't have a single fan in it. Maybe that's exaggerating. But the idea that now you can ramp that power up and increase the cooling and you have something that's hugely impressive. You know, maybe it'll take some time for that, those performance gains to actually be visible as, you know, companies like Adobe or whomever try and catch up. So you don't have to use iMovie and GarageBand to actually see it. But, no, I mean, based on all the stats that they're sharing, it's really impressive.
Yeah.
I
go for it, JD.
So I had this moment when I was watching this presentation and they were talking about how fast their chip is. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, you know, I run these programs on my Mac that if they don't seem like they should take that much energy, but I guess you kind of think about it and they do. And so you know, I have Chrome open for a bunch of web apps like Google Docs. And then I have my Slack open and like have iMessage open and have my, you know, iTunes open and listening to stuff. I was like, man, it'd be so cool to have that stuff up and like not have to worry about any laggy stuff going on as I'm working or kind of popping from one thing to the next, you know, like currently happens with my MacBook Pro from, you know, 2017. And then I kind of thought about that for a second, I was like, well, I bet you there are a bunch of dev teams, you know, at Adobe and at Google and at Apple or wherever, and just like, oh, cool, we can use all this new real estate to just like
exactly
pump a bunch more features in this thing and make it slow again. I don't know. Like, is this? I am totally ignorant when it comes to this stuff. Is this something that is like well known that this is something that happens, or am I just like imagining this in my head and I'm like making life worse than it needs to be? Because I want this to be a total panacea for my productivity, but I'm afraid it's just going to be like this weird war of attrition where it's just like everyone just one-upping one another.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's just like moving the goalposts every time. It's like how much space can we make and how much can we fill? It's kind of like, I don't think there's anything malicious to it, but that's definitely how it works. I mean, if you've got runway, you're going to take it.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the idea of software bloating is totally legitimate. You know, I'm granted, you know, doing a lot more stuff on my computer in terms of what I'm now able to do. But the idea that Chrome is using, you know, 8 gigs of memory or something is absurd for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, no, entirely. We need an armistice. I need to bring all of the people who make tech together. That's, I'm sure, their term as well, but the people who make tech, and just get them to agree. Development. Yeah, I want a photo like they had in, you know, at the end of World War II. Everyone get in a chair and wear cool outfits. Agree not to do anything bad.
It's going to be a photo at the end of The Shining, more like it, with that kind of, that's a horror story waiting to happen. There are a couple other things just to like make sure we touch on. Well, first of all, I should say I can speak to some of the performance of those chips. So like a couple stats here. The M1 Pro has a 10-core CPU and is 70% faster CPU performance. It's 70% faster than the M1, right? And the M1 Max has up to 400, I'm just comparing stats here. So these are the big ones. M1 Max has up to 400 gigabytes per second of memory bandwidth versus 200 in the M1 Pro. So like the Pro is much faster than the M1, and the M1 Max is much more powerful in other ways than the Pro. So they build up on each other. Did that clear anything up? Good. What about, okay, couple quick reactions to stuff like the notch. How do we feel about the notch coming in on the display?
I don't know why people are so mad about it.
Yeah.
Because it's dumb. It's just in the way.
It seems fine.
It's the same as you had before, but just get rid of bezels on the like left and right and bottom side.
Yeah. Nope.
It's good.
Fine.
Mr. Smooth Lines guy over here.
Yeah. Is that a hair joke? And so I've never been an AirPods owner. Never once. I've never even had AirPods in my ears, which seems really weird at this point. And to me, this update to AirPods seems really satisfying and tempting. Do you guys have any opinions on these? Yeah, shrug.
They seem cool. I mean, I bought a pair of cheap in-ear earbuds for like $67 3-4 years ago, and they still work. So being the thrifty man I am, I'm going to keep with them until they break, and maybe then I'll consider it. But I'm not. If at this point I haven't gotten earbuds, then like AirPods rather, than like, I don't know what's going to make me do it. Yeah. So it's obviously not this.
Maybe when Apple out-innovates themselves and puts some sort of like strap that goes over your head to connect them.
They're probably going to innovate some strap above or some wired cords together.
Wires, so you don't need to worry about batteries and then you're in business.
That could be cool.
I hate being like the conspicuous consumption guy here. I have had, save for the Max, I've had all of the AirPods. And the Pros are really great. And the shape is really nice, and they're kind of objectively better. But everything about the third generation ones seem really cool. And what they do kind of weirdly make me excited for is what the next generation of Pros might look like. Because I feel like in some way or another, the differentiating form factor is kind of like part of the thing. You know, the Pros are supposed to look different than the Pods. So, you know, maybe there's some sort of interesting larger scale shakeup to the Pros coming at some point.
It's a good, attitude to have, Henry. I like that.
I'll buy it.
My last thing I want to bring up, cause I'm not super clear on, this is not something I should admit in public, which this technically is, but it's because I didn't really read into it. The Apple Music voice plan is essentially not a full plan, right? You can just access it via Siri for a lower fee.
Super full plan, except you don't have an app.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no app. So you have to do it through Siri. That's the difference.
Well, I wonder if you could fire up like Apple Music to play and pause and maybe like find a radio station or something, but
it's all voice control. Yeah. I read there's a good piece over at The Verge about it, but yeah, it's all voice controlled. So it's all just through Siri connected speakers I don't think your phone. So it does seem like it's perfect for like a dentist's office. Like truly, like if I'm, you know, if I have my cute little, the little tangerine home pod, I like, I want to eat them. I want to peel them and eat them. I want to bite into them. Yeah, you just kind of plug in one of those and say, you know, for $4.99 a month, you have your lobby has Apple Radio on or something like that.
Right.
Or, that's my guess as to like what the thinking is there. Is it really is for people who like can say, hey, put this on radio or hey, play this particular song, and are okay to like not have their library like there for them to kind of browse through digitally. And cause I know that like, you know, I go to gyms or other places that have Pandora on or something like that. So I'm speculating wildly here, but I'd be interested if like maybe part of the thinking there was, yeah, sure, we're getting a more affordable option to consumers, but I wonder if it's like weirdly a B2B play almost in terms of software. So just like edging out like other, you know, Spotify or like a Pandora or something like that that's often kind of using to be played there.
Yeah, it is. It does seem weird. I think that may be one of the reasons I sort of avoided, like maybe subconsciously, I was just like avoiding wanting to know about it. But I do like the visual of you accidentally eating an AirPod, like it's a like wax fruit or something in a screwball comedy.
I kind of want to do it intentionally. Like I want to peel the HomePod, the little tiny HomePod, and I want to eat it.
We can do it like a TikTok unboxing, except it's you just like slowly eating technology.
Yeah. Yeah, and then go to the hospital.
That would do great on TikTok, I think, actually.
Probably would. That,
we're pivoting to TikTok.
Those guys.
There you go. okay, well, speaking of going, we're going to move on to something that really goes. I'm back on my transition BS. Okay.
It's pretty good, actually.
Thanks.
That was pretty good.
Thanks, guys. Porsche. Ever heard of it? Is that a better transition? I don't know. We'll let people decide. The person outside honking liked it. Okay, Porsche. The 718 Cayman is the most recent generation of what I refer to as the Boxster Coupe. But Porsche files will know that GT4 signifies a phenomenal car. The 718 Cayman GT4, a phenom. But Porsche has just given us a taste of the Cayman, 718 Cayman GT4 RS, and it is wildly fast. The RS, in this case, stands for Rennsport, which in English, that's German, Rennsport, in English means racing sport, and that, of course, means it is a track-focused version of this car, or it's meant for the track, at least. It lapped. So they sort of like revealed this version by revealing that the GT4 RS Cayman 718 lapped the Nürburgring Nordschleife in Germany, the famed racetrack there where Henry and I have driven together, in 7 minutes, just over 4.5 seconds.
It's about as fast as we drove it.
Yeah, I believe we were in an Opel Zafira, like the minivan stick
shift. I could actually tell you. We were in a Skoda Yeti.
Okay, fine.
Or maybe it was a Zafira.
Agree to disagree. I don't know. It was a strange day. Anyway, so 7 minutes, 4.5 seconds. That is just under 24 seconds faster than the regular GT4. And that is astonishing. I mean, that is a humongous leap. So the GT4 is powered by this 414 horsepower, naturally aspirated 4-liter flat six. I did say that in one breath. And the thing is, we don't have any real specs on the RS yet. So we're not definite on what exactly gives it such a boost in performance. But there is almost definitely a huge weight reduction in, you know, materials usage and all that. Plus a track-ready aero kit, including a wing and stuff. Lots of possibilities there. But Henry, partially because I know that you have kissed the ground of the Nürburgring, and because I know
literally,
yeah, we spent a long time just lip in the lap. I don't know. I couldn't come up with anything. So even though we're light on deets here, how does this feel as the last sort of internal combustion, kind of a swan song for the internal combustion Cayman?
I've always loved the really, I mean, I've loved the Cayman to some degree, in all of its guises, but I find that the really high end version super interesting, because you know, there's a threshold where they start to get more expensive, and sometimes significantly more expensive than 911s. And I can really respect someone who buys a really fast Cayman over a
hell yeah,
similarly fast 911. Cause they're really cool. I love this car, and I'm sure the RS is going to be great, and it's going to have a huge wing on it. it's gonna be really fun, and I, you know, it's, they're gonna get driven around London and New York with mm-hmm. huge frequency, but mm-hmm. You know, I like to think that because it's a Cayman, somehow people will be slightly less precious about it and go really fast and nearly crash them, but not crash them.
It's oddly specific. Hope,
I don't know.
Yeah, the one of my favorite sort of qualities of the Cayman since it's like existed is that in certain specs it outperforms the 911, like a similarly sort of spec 911, I believe. I don't think I'm getting that wrong, but yeah, it's a cool car. JD, what about you? Are you gonna hop in one of these as soon as you can?
Hell yeah! You wanna give one to me?
Yeah, I'm sending one your way.
Thanks, man. I can be like the guys outside of my apartment late in the night driving very, very fast in the BQE. I mean, the car looks very cool and very fast. There is something though about the stat of like this thing did the Nürburgring in like this number of seconds that like, if you know it, very cool, very mm-hmm. like, it's a good benchmark, but you know, like I hope people who do buy this just drive them on the track, but there is something kind of funny about, I don't know, buying a car that's that fast and like driving them on the street, right? And like, if you're driving it anywhere close to that, you should be in jail. You know, that like, there's something kind of odd to me about like, you're buying a car with this much power. Like, I really do hope you're going to the track like every weekend and like really opening it up and trying to find the limit and get a really good lap in. But I know that ultimately, this is, you know, knowing the stat like that will just be kind of the equivalent of buying, like, I don't know, some kind of huge AR for your home just for no other reason, just to have it there, even though you, like, live in the suburbs of, like, Sacramento or something. I don't know. So I frankly have very few intelligent things to say about cars, but this one looks very fast, and I would love to be in it.
Yeah, that's true. I saw, similar to this, the 911, there's a variant called the GT2 RS, which is just a bonkers car, right? I mean, just face melting kind of performance. And the last time I saw one was in Monterey during Monterey Car Week. The only other time I remember seeing one on the road was like the previous month, right here by my apartment on the BQE, like you were mentioning. This guy just sort of like idling by me in my Jeep, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, I can't even get performance out of this old ass Cherokee. There's no way you're enjoying yourself driving that car, you fool. You guys watch the lap at all?
Yeah, it's mesmerizing. Watching people do hot laps like that is like watching waves crash on a beach or fire in a fire pit. It's totally mesmerizing.
It's so wonderful. Yeah. And this, they have the full telemetric sort of thing. Yeah. And you can, they track you on the, or they track the car on the, you know, the map. Very cool to watch. And we'll drop a link down there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll all agree that there's going to be a big wing. It's going to be really fast and cool. And it's just, I don't know, something so I mean, this is always the way it is with performance cars, like the new NSX Type S that just came out. Is, you know, a more powerful, better performing version of the NSX before it's gone. And this is another one, like the Cayman won't go away. It's going to be electric, but as sort of like the last one that'll burn gas, really, really interesting way to go out with a bang, you know,
Succession. Not of a bang. Bangs. Black.
Yeah. Oh, Succession. You guys watching Succession?
I'm actually just restarted the first season.
Oh my gosh. It's just, I could survive on it. I think I could forego food for a month and just watch Succession at last. Okay. So, speaking of expensive things and people in Succession have expensive watches, we're going to talk about watches now. And there's a very sort of controversial story going on here, to say the least. And I'm going to give JD a little time to really get himself pumped up, because we're going to let him loose. But here's the story. Braymont has introduced the Longitude Limited Edition collection of watches. They're really pretty, comprising these 40 millimeter watches. There's three variants, very classic looks, inspired by vintage marine chronometers. But the real story is inside, it's the guts. So the company introduced a new in-house automatic movement that's designed at their new facility in England called the Wing. And the movement comes in a few different complications, which are really cool. And it's called the ENG 300. ENG, England, get it? It's exceedingly rare for a watchmaker to successfully build its own custom movement, just because there are so many, you know, the specialized demands of production and assembly, these really tiny little precise parts, all this stuff. But Braymont specifically has always vowed to bring watch manufacturing back home to England, where it, you know, once thrived, in a manner of speaking. And with this, they have, right? Well, the long story short is that Braymont didn't literally design every piece of the ENG 300. Instead, the company purchased the, quote, intellectual rights and plans from a Swiss brand called V Plus, unquote. I think it's pronounced the plus. It's the word the and then a plus sign. So then Braymont took the design and modified about 80% of it. So a lot of it to fit these new watches. And now it's this magnificent timepiece. So we're going to talk about that. And by which I mean, I'm going to cue JD now to just start talking about the watch nerd uproar that he has already sort of spoken to Henry and me about personally.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, Watch Nerd used that in a very affectionate way. I am yes. One as well. But yeah, you know, this movement is a big deal for Vermont, something they worked on for a very long time, worked very hard on. They're very proud of it. And I think they have every right to be. It's impressive to see a company pull this off. And frankly, it looks gorgeous. I mean, and the watches themselves look very attractive. You know, I think my kind of raises my hackles a little bit about this, or what frustrates me about the kind of quality of the conversation surrounding this release, and about some of the folks who are saying that, like, this isn't really an in-house movement, is this. It seems to me like these definitions are such a moving target that there doesn't seem to actually be an agreed upon, like, static set of criteria for, like, what makes something an in-house or in-house or other movement, right? Like, what's the kind of classification? And kind of absent that, it can feel like it's just at the whim of a bunch of people who are very disconnected from the actual manufacturing process as to what they think is the most pure version of an in-house movement. And the fact of the matter is, and this is very similar to a conversation that goes on a lot about what, like, American made constitutes, right? There's a lot of vagaries around this stuff. I mean, people who will say it's American made because it's built in America, or it's not American made because the materials it's made out of it isn't, aren't themselves sourced from American soil, right? Yep. And there are a lot of different kind of gradations from there. And so in a lot of ways, this is a kind of version of that same conversation without the kind of nationalist vibe to it. So that's the kind of like lay of the land. I think some of the frustration there, I would just say that, like, I think it's too bad that this is kind of where things get to. Because let's say that we did have this very agreed upon idea as to what is an in-house movement and what isn't. When you read about the length of time and the amount of effort that Bremont put into making this to begin with, you would be insane to say anything other than it's impressive that it's an accomplishment. And look, I'm not like a huge Bremont stan or something like that. I think that, like, it's very easy to get caught up in the fights around definitions and lose the forest for the trees when you're talking about like what has actually been accomplished here. So I don't know. I think that's just my take on it. And I think it's I probably have more to say here, but I'm kind of getting tripped up over myself. But that's kind of my read on it. Ultimately, I do think it's very cool. And I guess I'll just say one more thing before I kind of shut my trap. There's something to be said about the fact that, like, COSC, which is this body in Switzerland that certifies watches and certifies like a chronometer, for instance, they won't certify these watches because they're not sufficiently made in Switzerland. They'll only do this for Swiss watches. So this is enough of an English watch that, like, this body won't certify them. And so as a result, Bremont has their own testing steps and facilities that they've invested into so they can make sure these are really up to snuff. And I don't know, as far as an objective measure goes as to like what constitutes like a watch that's like, or a movement that's produced in-house versus not, that feels like a pretty good one. I'm sure listeners or readers will have ideas as to what other ones are. I just kind of want to point out, like, there's a lot that's gone into this thing, and I just think it's damn impressive.
Yeah, I mean, very well said, and very complete too. And you know, I commend you on being restrained. One thing you mentioned, then I'll go to you, Henry, is that how long it took the company to sort of develop this. Apparently they put like 20 years into making this happen. So, and this is for a limited edition watch so far, at least. There will be like 300 examples, right? 20 years for 300 watches is pretty freaking wild. In terms of the debate about where things are made, it reminds me of cars, right? Like, what is an American made car anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hear that all the time, but maybe not quite as vehemently as our watch friends. What do you think, Henry?
Yeah, it's a deep rabbit hole, man. I kind of made the mistake of going down it just now, or earlier, and it's like it pushes any sort of like idea that you may be an enthusiast about something, watches in this case, to the absolute limit. Yeah. Like, you know, I read three or four comments and I find myself just like throwing my hands in the air and saying, I just don't care.
Yeah.
I just don't care. You know, I think there is some interesting merit to the idea of just the kind of general idea of an independent watchmaker, making the thing from scratch. I think that's cool. I think there's something really noble about that. And I imagine, you know, as an employee of Bremont, it would be incredibly cool to try and just do it. As someone who, you know, owns and uses watches, I just don't care. I just don't care. Like, you know, if I get a pizza from a pizza place, and the pepperoni is not made in house; it is sourced from somewhere else. I don't care.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, there's something to be said about that. I think that, like, I don't know. It raises this talk about like deep holes. I mean, it raises this question. So they bought the intellectual property from this Swiss brand that made this movement. and they built on it. They customized it, and they said about 80% of it they really kind of customized, and there was even more that they kind of worked on to just like in terms of the just transparent case back on these watches, and so you can see more of the movement. And so they did a lot to just make it look the way they want it to look, as opposed to not even just customizing outside of that. So it's like, where does knowledge come from, right? Like that's almost where I get to, whereas like, yeah, in this, like there's a commercial transaction at the heart of this where they bought the property, intellectual property for this movement. But you do end up in this weird place where if you're saying that like, it's, you can't like, are my thoughts original? Cause I paid for college. like that's probably too much of a stretch. I think I'm going way too far out on a limb here, but you do get in these weird places where it's so, if you want to be the person who discounts and excludes somebody from some made up club, it's really easy to do it. It's really easy to say no, because this, that, or the other thing, this doesn't count. And so it's really easy to exclude, and it's a lot harder to be in a position where you're trying to make the argument for something. And I think that's the kind of difficult position that Vermont's put themselves in. You know, it's difficult to make this to begin with, but the kind of added difficulty is that they have to then defend it a bunch about what they did, why they did it. Because in addition to this being, you know, something they wanted to do almost for the soul of watchmaking, if you could probably wave your hands about that kind of stuff. It's a commercial enterprise, right? And if you have an ability to like work off of the knowledge of another group and be able to like still add enough of your own heart and soul into something, to make it different enough, and to make it as much your own, so much so that some Swiss certification won't actually certify your watches as chronometers, then, like, I don't know, and you got to take it, and it'll still take 20 years.
Yeah, there actually is. It is too bad, right? That sounds like this is such a cool product, such a an impressive sort of like benchmark for any company, that it's overshadowed by, you know, some naysayers, I guess. But it does, like the car analogy comes up to me naturally, for one. But like the Shelby Cobra back in the 60s, like that was a British car that Carroll Shelby ripped the guts out of and put American stuff inside, like a big old V8 and, you know, big tires and all sorts of stuff. And that is an amazing car. It's an icon. It changed everything. And, you know, if you're discounting something because it's not pure, I mean, that is, of course, I think we know from history, problematic for many reasons, but like, it's just sort of like unfortunate at best, you know, that, like I say, overshadowing such an accomplishment. Henry, you.
Yeah. I mean, okay.
Yeah. I think it's again, like it's very admirable. I'm glad that they're doing it and found someone to fund them doing it. You know, more innovation is always a good thing. But I can't quite pin down the why. I guess it's kind of been Bremont's like ultimate goal is to make watches in England. I don't know. I'm a bad person to ask because I just want to get a Swiss watch.
Well, that's kind of the thing though. You're like, JD, you brought up that like, essentially certifying these watches isn't there isn't a uniform process across the board. So like, you know, it starts to, it's a problem. If I wanted to, you know, start making a completely American made in-house movements for watches, like I want someone to tell me my watch is good too. And then it sort of like dismantles this whole system. Everything gets shaken up and, you know, the watch world is notoriously kind of stodgy. If this is a way to evolve it into, you know, being a little more globalist, maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, who knows? I mean, there could probably be an entire other episode about the kind of, the political undertones to all of the different kind of like certifications for different things being made in different countries, or, you know, like cartels around like what can be made where and why, and the kind of protectionism that happens with certain industries and becomes calcified over a long period of time. I think a lot of that stuff is stuff I don't quite understand completely. For the why for this, Henry, from what I was reading on this stuff as well, there was a period in which Britain was England was the place where the watches were made. That had a kind of strong history there. And look at GMT, right? Greenwich Mean Time is being like running right through there. There is a kind of history there, and I can see why there would be, a kind of, in the same way that folks like to make selvedge denim in the U.S. and sell it for way too much. so do watchmakers, man. There's this element of nationalism and pride there that's, nationalism often gets a pretty negative connotation, but in this instance, I'm not sure if it deserves it. So I think that's the why. I don't know where I'm going with all of this. It's just interesting. It seems like a really cool watch. Like, I'm happy for you.
Can't we all just get along? We can wrap it up. And like I said, 300 examples of this whole thing. There are three variations of steel, 150 of which will be made. And then rose gold, there will be 75. And then white gold, there will be 75. Each has a different dial execution. And steel examples will be $17,000. The white gold versions will be $25,000. So, on top of all the other just sort of like amazing qualities of this watch, clearly Bremont stands behind their product. They're pricing it accordingly as like, a thing that they made and are proud of. And no doubt people are going to cherish these regardless of controversy over the pond. All right. Final thoughts, Henry, are you going to purchase, which are you going to get? Do you think?
I'm going to get all of them. And preserve them in a kind of like bulldog shaped watch winder box.
That's a Churchill reference.
That was a Churchill reference. I will say, if you're not particularly tied to the Isle of England or Great Britain, there's some really amazing independent smaller watchmakers that do in-house movements and like truly in-house and truly impressive. I keep coming back to our glorious autumn holiday years ago, Nick, where we went through Germany and hung out with the folks at Nomos who have done
unbelievable time,
an independent and fully in-house movement. It's truly impressive. So, I don't want to discount any of the work that Bremont has done. It is really cool, and I'm glad that they have the resources to do it and can continue to do it. But there are some really cool independent watchmakers, and I don't want to sell anybody short based on where they're from.
Hondo P, that's a good final word. Nomos was, we toured the whole kit and caboodle, met everybody, saw them do their thing. Regardless of who is making a watch, that is just an astonishing process, and so beautiful and really cool. So, like you said, JD, lots more to come. We could probably talk about this for a long time, but we're not going to, because we've already been talking for a long time and it's time to stop. So thank you both for being here. Thanks everybody for listening in. If you want any information about anything we talked about, including that video of the Porsche lapping the Nürburgring, a story I wrote about the Nürburgring, all of our coverage of the Apple releases, and a bunch of stuff about this new limited edition collection of in-house movements from jolly old England. Check out the show notes and the posts there. Make sure you hit us up on social media at Gear Patrol. One word, hit us up email. That is podcast@gearpatrol.com. ask us questions, drop us comments, weigh in on what we were just talking about. I'm sure there are a couple friendly watch nerds out there who want to give us what for or props. And if you like what you hear, subscribe to the pod. You can rate on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars. It'll keep us going. Henry, JD, thank you both for your time. JD, I hope you can snack on a HomePod Mini sometime soon. And yeah, and we'll have you guys back, I guess, sometime, and we'll do this again. Yeah, for sure. And for Gear Patrol, I am Nick Caruso, and until next time, take care.